Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. And we are back this week. All three of us are back together again. I guess if we include Headless Steve and Jeff, what is your mannequin's name?
Oh, that's Al.
Al. So we got Headless Steve here and then Al. So there's five, well, I guess four and three quarters of us here tonight. I was just telling Jeff before the show, I had to take Steve apart. I got to get ready to cut his 82nd Airborne patch off and put on the 101st Airborne patch because this month is flying by. Jeff, you're a teacher. You know, it's like Carrie was telling me, oh, spring break. I'm thinking April. Wow. You guys are almost done with the school year already. June's going to be here before you know it.
What are you doing, dog?
So anyhow, I can't believe how quick it's coming. I think the first weekend of April, I have an event that we've discussed here a little bit. It's not even an event per se. It's actually a invite-only fundraiser. The South Florida Honor Flight is having a soiree or something to raise money to obviously fund.
What in the heck are you?
Hold on one moment. Just put him in the bedroom and shut the door. He's in here, like, fidgeting and making a ruckus. Hold on. So I came home last week to this.
Oh, my gosh.
She's adorable. She's a dead ringer for our original beagle, but she's not housebroken, and she doesn't know not to chew on wires yet. And the last place you want this is to run roaming in your podcast studio during recording. So everybody say hi to little Chloe.
Hi, Chloe.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, I feel like given where she's been in the last few minutes, I think a Monica is a pretty good name for her too.
Don't listen to him. She don't have a blue dress on.
Anyway.
So anyhow, I'll have to cut that out later. Good thing we're not live anymore. I'm hearing this rough, I'm hearing like this noise. I'm like, and then she's down there like knocking all my crap around. But anyhow. Got to select invite only. Remember, actually, we've kind of discussed this in the past. The photo shoot I did with the movie Memphis Belle was with the Florida Flyboys. They invited me to come down. They actually had a flight suit and a lot of stuff to fit me. Only thing I had to do was bring my Boondockers and some HBTs. So anyhow, they invited me. They know that I have an airborne impression because they're going to do Air Corps, airborne, service troops, and a few others. I think there's like six reenactors going. And so they asked me to do my airborne impression, but they asked me to remove the 82nd Airborne patch and put on 101st because we're actually going to have a 101st Airborne veteran there. So they thought he's going to be here. So just cut that patch off if you don't mind. So I got to do that. Cool thing is years ago, I was doing the Georgia event. And prior to me getting those service boots, I used to just wear my airborne jump boots with leggings over them when I did my infantry. But I've had him for years, and I think I showed Jeff when it happened. My stitching gave out on my insole, right in the middle. I found a guy. I took it to Red Wing Boots. They said, oh, we don't do this stuff in-house anymore. It'll be gone 6 to 8 weeks. I'm like, that's not an option. And she said, there's a small mom-and-pop family here in Cape Coral, so I drove over there. Now, in order to do them correctly, to stitch the entire sole, they need new heels because you got to take the heel off in order to fit it through the machine. Now, I know you can get heels online for like $25, but I didn't have the time. So this guy is going out of his way just to hand stitch and glue that one section where the stitching is broke just so I can have these boots in time for the event. And then wow. I'll go online, order the heels, and take them back over there and have them redone.
That's pretty cool.
He charged me $40 to hand stitch these things.
Wow.
So that's a deal and a half. So I got to pick those up Wednesday, and we're carpooling. And I'm going to take – I doubt the guy will have time. But I would hate to find out that I just, you know, that this event's going to be going all day and I could have possibly gone to a side room and interviewed some of these people. So I'm going to take the podcast studio in a box with us just in case. With that being said, with the way we are recording and scheduling now, I hope you all enjoyed last week's episode where we interviewed the 105-year-old John Skeen. That was one of the most... probably one of my favorite interviews. And we all discussed how we do our interviews. And just the greatest compliment I can get. His handler, the guy who schedules all the interviews with the local news, the newspapers, all these different events, he sat there and live streamed it. And afterwards, he said, that was the best interview I've ever sat through. Wow. And the reason is because how we've discussed at nauseam how we do our interviews. No pre-written questions. Because the way we do interviews, he said, it was the best interview he's ever sat through. And he's seen them all, local news, national news, magazines, newspapers, the whole gambit. He said he loved the way that we do our interview styles here, and it made for a great interview. So that was an
awesome, man. Awesome, well done. Time.
105 years old, 2-hour interview, and I barely talked at all.
Wow.
He was one of those guys. He was super lucid. Used a walker, but other than that, one of those guys, you just put that quarter coin in there, that question coin. Here's my question. And he would do what we want. He provides the answer, and that turns into a story. And 15 minutes later, 20 minutes later, I'm asking question number two. And so it's perfect.
That's awesome.
And I can only hope and pray to be that lucid and that, you know, energetic at 105. And one of the things I ask him at the end of the interview, which I like to do with these veterans, is I ask them a non-war-based question, you know, any tips, suggestions for the kids of nowadays or what have you. But I asked him, I said, you know, from what I understand, people say if you want to live to a longer age, the key is to have something to do in the morning. You know, you hear all the time, you know, people retire early. They don't have hobbies. They don't have friends. They kind of, you know, age quicker. Whereas people who retire later, or they retire but then find a side hobby, maybe go get the job, say hi at Home Depot, work in volunteer work. He gets up, he goes down to the Pittsburgh Pirates training facility up there in Bradenton. He goes to, every Wednesday, he goes to a local veterans breakfast. His schedule is constantly packed. He's constantly doing stuff because it gives him a reason to get up and gives
him a lesson there,
a purpose in life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that was a great show. Jeff, give us an update on the air show.
Yeah, well, you know, here in the Hill Country, March is the worst month to plan anything outdoors because it could be 80, it could be 20, it could be hail, it could be snow, it could be rain, it could be sleet, it could be ridiculously humid. March is all of the seasons here in the Hill Country. Unfortunately, this year, the 80 degree weather stopped, and then like the 40, 50 degree and rainy weather moved in just for like a day. And that happened to be the day of our air show. But what was the silver lining here was, you know, I think 2 years ago we broke an attendance record here at this air show. And it's a small airport, right? It's a small town, and we want to keep it that way. So we kind of coined it's the biggest little air show in Texas. So our highest attended air show 2 years ago was 6,100 and change. The record before that was like 5,000. So we blew it away.
Before you give us the new tote estimate, just for comparison, what is the population of this town in which this air show roughly takes place?
Less than 6,000.
So before you even broke your previous record, you guys were already bringing in more than the population of the town
for
this air show, which I'm sure is a huge boost for the local economy, gas stations, restaurants, the whole nine.
Yeah. That's a big deal. And it's not the biggest in April, which is our annual Blue Bonnet Festival. If you're not familiar, Blue Bonnet's a big blue flower that everybody loves. That the locals are like, yep, it's a weed. Take your pictures and move on. but I want to say 20,000, 10, 15, 20,000 people, I think, come in. But it's a week-long festival, right? Live music, all the stuff going on. So whether there's nowhere 6,000 people.
Hey, hold on for a second.
Every possible aircraft.
You're buffering. Hold on. I'm going to put a cue in here so we can go and edit that buffer out. Let's just give your internet a second to catch up so people can hear what you're saying, because you went full max headroom on that.
Dang.
Go ahead and try again. Start at, I think, the 20,000 people. Or actually, just go ahead and start again answering when I asked what the population was, because you started breaking up at that point.
So population is less than 6,000 people here. So yeah, when we bring in 6,000 to the air show, that's already more than the population of the town. And we have another annual event that here in April called the Bluebonnet Festival, having to do with our local blue flower that grows here seasonally. And that brings somewhere around 20,000 people. So pretty big draw. However, we knew with the weather, no way we're going to hit 6,000 people, and that's okay. Every aircraft that was supposed to be coming in, Houston, Dallas, it was just kind of nasty weather all around us. And on our waiver, we needed a 1,000-foot ceiling, right? Essentially, from the runway to the cloud cover needed to be at least 1,000 feet. And we had about 400 feet and dropping. I mean, it was just not real rainy, not real wet, but just way overcast. So naturally that morning in the pilot's briefing, when they knew nothing was really going to fly, everybody in the room was like, okay, Jeff, with the ground axe, what are you going to do? So,
stretch,
you know, I
told stretch, filler.
Exactly. Yeah. So I told him my plan. I already had three acts planned out anyway, weapon demonstrations and dressing a kid up in World War II, you know, Air Corps gear and kind of talking about it, making it comical for folks and all that stuff, talking about the museum and some of the, you know, other attractions we've got there. Colonel McPhail did show up. He's our last surviving, you know, F-4U Corsair pilot from World War II, and then flew Corsairs again in Korea. So super guy, he was there. But then it was my display inside the hangar with the C-47, and I mean, there was people everywhere. And for hours, even my wife came out, Tammy, and she said, you know, babe, I was trying to get a picture of you, but there was just so many people crowded around you and around the tables.
Now, was there a PA system, or are you enunciating to the 14th row?
No, so there's a paid, basically, he's the MC of the air show. He's the announcer, you know, so the air boss and announcer tag team, and I've worked with both of those guys at other air shows as well. They're there every year, and yeah, they're awesome. Rob Lowe, not the actor, Rob Lowe is the announcer. He likes to introduce himself. He's like, I'm not Rob Lowe at DirecTV. I'm the Rob Lowe with cable. Yeah.
Basic.
He's a great announcer.
No, I guess I meant with that crowd, were you trying to yell your presentation or were you amplified some?
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I'm handing a microphone, so it can be conversational between the announcer and myself. And,
gotcha.
You know, so we can read off of each other, even if I'm done. If I know he's asking me a few more questions.
So it's almost like a panel, like a one-person panel or two-person panel.
Yeah.
Cool.
Exactly. But man, like I said, silver lining here, when all was said and done, there was like over 3,000 people there. So the fact that we at least met half of our record and didn't have a single airplane leave the ground was pretty cool. And it kind of shows how people were touring the C-47. They're, you know, walking. I had three tables set up. Logan had his airborne / you know, Wehrmacht uniform stuff there. So he was all Pathfinder everything. Had my Jeep there. You know, I mean, just perfect stuff for kids to take pictures with and everything. And it was an awesome day. And you know, it was kind of a neat way to start off. This is my favorite time of year, I think. You know, it's the beginning of air show season. It's the beginning of reenacting season. It's, you know, the hockey playoffs are about to start. I mean, there's all these, you know, exciting things this time of year. So that has led to now three more events I've got on the docket. And I don't think I can make all three of them, but I know I can make at least two. And that is for anybody in the San Antonio area, on the 20th of April, it's another CAF event, first time they're doing it, out at Stinson Airfield, which is a really, really cool historic airfield, really nice aircraft down there as well. That's headquartered down there. I believe they'll have some other warbirds flying in, but they're doing a breakfast taco fly-in kind of thing. couple aircraft fly in, couple aircraft on display, you know, a few of us reenactors, you know, ground displays, things like that. Really looking forward to that. And that weekend will also be coupled with, I'm going to be staying with our man here, Blocker, and we are going to binge watch.
Yeah.
Masters of the Air.
Well, let me know what weekend you guys do that so I can do the same thing. And then that following Monday, we can finally give people our assessment of the show.
Yeah,
sure. Absolutely.
Yeah,
we'll let you know for sure. And then I think it's like 2 weeks later, got an invite to go back up to CAF headquarters in Dallas for their Warbird weekend. And that's always a fun time at CAF headquarters. You know, that's the home of Fifi the B-29, Diamond Lil B-24, and several other premier, you know, commemorative Air Force aircraft up there. But I think the highlight is there is a B-17 flying in that I have never seen before coming in from Arizona. In fact, they've got a B-25 coming from Arizona, too. I'm trying to think of the name of that one. But the B-17, Sentimental Journey. I have never seen it. If you're familiar with the famous picture of Betty Grable looking over her shoulder, that's the nose art on Sentimental Journey.
Pretty awesome.
Oh, man. Big silver bird with a big blue stripe on her tail. And like I said, it's I think I've seen four or five B-17s in my life and been inside all of them except for the original Memphis Belle. That wasn't an option. Man, to see Sentimental Journey, Blocker's coming up with me again. You know, he's going to help me set up and display. You know, I'll bring several tables of artifacts, and you know, he can help talk about what's a scuttlebutt and represent there as well. And I think probably the coolest part is we get to just kind of throw up a World War II cot out there in the grass under the wing of an aircraft and just camp there.
Yeah, which that's is pretty like, awesome.
You can always take two shelter halves and do a lean-to over top each cot too.
Yeah. No, we're not that close.
No, I'm not saying to get. No, I'm not saying make a shelter half. I'm saying take a shelter, split it in half. Then you guys can have your cot, but have a lean to over one side. So, you know, a wind blocker the very next day would be a nice place to get out of the shade. Because I've actually,
Well, I think so. The display will be inside the hangar that Fifi sits in.
Okay.
But you know, we just can't sleep in there. We'll just be outside next to the ramp there, in the grassy area. But yeah, that's a ton of fun. I mean, they have the largest collection of nose art from World War II, the actual panels from the aircraft that were cut apart and salvaged. They have all of this nose art. Dennis, I don't know if you've seen that.
No, never.
Yeah, so I can't wait to take you through there. And I just wish Don could just hop on a plane and meet us there first week of May in Dallas. Man, it'd be amazing.
It'd be so good.
If all things go plan, I'll be on a cruise ship, so definitely out. It'll be interesting when you guys report back, especially Jeff, you, because you've been going for so many years consecutively. If you see kind of if you notice kind of a bump in attendance due to Masters of the Air bringing people out who may be curious to see some of these warbirds and planes of the era, because we always talk about the impact these series and these shows have on pop culture. So what a better way to kind of gauge new interest than to see, wow, we went and it was shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, no, I fully expect that. I mean, even at the air show here a couple weeks ago, one of the pilots came up to me. He's like, hey, didn't I just see you on Apple TV? I'm like, yeah, okay. So, yeah, I mean, I'm pumped about it. And I think I've told Dennis, I know before, like, you know, being such a big fan of the Bloody 100th and meeting the guys that I have from the 100th Bomb Group, reading the books that I have, you know, I think the very first book I read on anything that had to do with the air war, I was about 14, 15, somewhere in there. And it was Harry Crosby's memoir, Wing and a Prayer. And I just recently found out he's one of the featured characters in the series. And I just thought, man, you know, it's about time. But then, you know, on the other side of the coin, it's like, man, if I do anything 100th, it's going to just look like a bandwagon, Masters of the Air. Oh, you know, everybody's Bloody 100th now.
Yeah. Well, now you know what it's like when fans of bands that used to be considered underground before they made it big, and now all of a sudden they're all over every TV show, every commercial, and everything. Like, yeah. Kind of liked it better. It was just our little thing, but okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm just recently shopping for some nice leather, you know, patches to sew on my A2. Originally, I wanted to do the 100th. I thought, you know what? No. No. Well, I'm not going to be like everybody else up there. So, I mean, I'm too much of a Memphis Belle fan anyway to veer away from, you know, the 324th Bomb Squadron, 91st Bomb Group. So that's the markings I'm going to do. And I ordered the custom, you know, leather name tape for it as well. So it should be looking pretty good before the next event.
I think John of the Florida Flyboys, I think he actually hand paints all their bomber jackets. He's a pretty decent, at least in that style of drawing. He hand paints all theirs, and
wow,
yeah. it looks real nice. And I think he puts some sort of coating on it to keep it from flaking off and all that stuff. But yeah, they do one offs. Yeah. It's really cool.
Jeff, was there any other World War II veterans that showed up that day for the air show? There were just kind of random shows.
Actually, there was, and I didn't get to talk to him. But we've had her on the show before, Liberty Phillips. She came up with Operation Meatball, and she told me she was bringing a veteran, Ray. Gosh, I can't think of his last name now. He was at the air show 2 years ago and was super pumped to come out for it. Navy during World War II, and then actually ended up joining the Air Force. And then flew B-52s all the way up through Vietnam. So he served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam in some capacity. So, man, I wish I had been able to talk to him. I was doing one of my presentations. They drive her by with him in a golf cart, and they wave, and I just kind of wave. And then that was it. I didn't see him, and she told me, she said, you know, he was getting kind of chilly and didn't think we were going to get started, you know, with anything. They thought it was just postponed. You know, I told us to know everything was actually grounded. But so, yeah, I mean, to see two World War II vets there, I mean, it's a shame to say, but that's, you know, now that's a lot to have in an event.
I know. It's wild. What's wild?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll take what we can get.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember going to I went to an air show up in
Actually, let's can I put a pause on this real quick, just because we're on the topic of veterans, and I want to make sure we get this out, and then we'll go to Dennis's favorite memories of air shows. Scott reached out to us, Scott Freund. He reached out to us on the What's the Scuttlebutt Facebook page via a private message, because we shared one of his posts, and he said, hey, I want to thank you guys for sharing my post about Peleliu trip. We really want to get Al Chatwin and another Peleliu veteran back to the island for the 80th anniversary at no cost to them, of course, or their escorts. I have attached a link for donations. If you could please let everyone know about it, that would be fantastic. So if you guys head over to www.wwiibeyondthecall.com, so World War II beyondthecall.com. And you guys can donate there. And I also included a link on our Facebook page, and it will be up on whatsthescuttlebutt.com as well. So if you guys want to contribute in any sort of small way to help get two veterans back to the Pacific for the 80th anniversary of Peleliu, head over to World War II beyondthecall.com and donate there. Just wanted to get that out there. And while you're there, as always, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on our YouTube link, subscribe, watch some of our videos. And this is probably the last chance. I think the next episode we were going to be doing the drawing. And so if you haven't signed up for Patreon yet and you really want to get this a chance to win this beautiful print from Valor Studios off the line, this is your last chance. Head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, sign up for Patreon, and any and all active subscribers, with the exception of the gentleman who won the last one, will be eligible to win. And I think this time we'll have Dennis Blocker do the name drawing. That way people can't be mad at me or Jeff.
Yeah.
And Dennis can.
Yeah, and you know, that Peleliu trip, they're doing a documentary out of it too. Gibson's supposed to be there. In fact, I talked to him a couple weeks ago. Of course, he invited me out there, and I'm like, yeah, let me drop everything, go to freaking Peleliu. But I think they think they may have Henry going with them.
Nice.
Henry Sledge, our old friend. I don't know if that's confirmed or not yet, but I think, you know, financially they got to get this thing rolling. Yeah. But that would be super cool to see the documentary, you know, and with those guys over there and what they do. It would be really slick to see. Scott Freund is such an awesome guy and does so well with SFR Productions, and the things that he's produced on just look at his stuff on YouTube. My gosh, I mean, he's been all over the Pacific and he's produced some really good, you know, video quality, you know, video material, you know, documenting different battles and things. But yeah,
speaking of Henry, he's supposed to come down to Orlando next month to do a World War II in May. Yeah, April. I'm so behind. But in May, he's supposed, and I'll put, once it's confirmed, I'll put the link up on our page. He's supposed to come to Orlando for a World War II armored event. And obviously, cool. If he does, I'm going to go up there. It's only a 4-hour drive. And finally get to meet him in person after all these years. And yeah. So I will keep you guys updated. But Dennis,
did they have that thing in Peleliu? Did that happen? Or Tarawa, I'm sorry, Tarawa, this past November?
No, something came up. I can't remember
what
it was.
It didn't happen?
No.
No. Scott, he's in the middle of a move from Texas to Tennessee. And then they're also hosting some of the Band of Brothers actors to jump in Georgia there. And then I guess some of them are going to jump in Normandy from what I've heard.
Yeah, right
after they train there. And, you know, of course, I got the invite to go out there. And I'm like, yeah, I hate you guys.
Yeah.
Not gonna make that
but either. It was the 80th, right? It was the 80th in November, this last November, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For Patio.
Yeah, for Tarawa. Yeah, that was supposed to be something. And Bonnieman's grandson was going to be the tour guide for the whole thing. And yeah. But no, I think that fell through. So I'm hoping they can make this Peleliu thing happen, which is coming up in September, and it's not far away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So head over to worldwar2beyondthecall.com/events.
So interesting side note about Peleliu, like the gunboats that led the invasion there, those invasion waves, the LCI firing rocket gunboats, those were actually my grandpa's flotilla. And, those were the fightingest gunboats in the Pacific Flotilla 3. It's interesting because the gunboats that went there missed Iwo Jima. And so, you know how they have three groups to each flotilla, and group 8, my grandpa's gunboat group, man, they had been through all this combat, the Marshalls and the Marianas, and then they divided them up. So they went to Peleliu, 7 and 9 went to Peleliu, group 9. And then my grandpa then went to Iwo Jima. But that was kind of cool when we were talking about the video games the other day, Don, was that one World War II video game where you get to actually be an LCI gunboat. That was my grandpa's crew, grandpa's flotilla. So that's kind of cool.
Hell yeah. That's very, very cool.
Yeah. That'd be cool if they can pull that off, the 80th anniversary of Peleliu, man. I have some sand from Peleliu sitting here on beside my desk here. Kind of remind me.
Yeah, because I think, if I remember correctly, aren't we repurposing some of those islands down there right now? And so some of those landmarks are going to be forever changed here real soon. And so to get those guys down there and experience it in its current state, opposed to what it possibly could look like 3 years from now, you know, it's even more important. Not to mention, as Jeff implied earlier, that we're running out of time with these vets, and so it'd be very cool to for them to succeed in their quest to get those guys down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Dennis, talk about I know you said you had some favorite air show memories. I mean, I think to me they're the best. I mean, that's kind of where it all starts as a kid.
Yeah, to get absolutely. Involved
in World War II is that an air show?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, couldn't have said it any better. I mean, it's what inspires you, seeing all the aircraft. And first air show I ever went to was in Keflavik, Iceland, about 1983. The Paris Air Show was going on. Of course, we couldn't go to that. But what was interesting was that my dad was a sniper in the Air Force, a cop. And the Space Shuttle Enterprise was sitting on top of the 747, and they were flying it over to the Paris Air Show, and it did a stopover at Keflavik to refuel before making the final leg over to France. And so I got to go out there and see, of course, my dad, you know, has access to the flight line and this and that. So I got to go out there and see it. And I got a signed photograph of the space shuttle on top of the 747 by one of the 747 pilots. And then I got a great picture of my dad on top of the hangar with his sniper rifle, protecting the space shuttle while it was there. But you know, that's where it all starts. You know, when you're a little kid and you're, you know, just everything is larger than life. And I did go to a air show. I want to say it was San Marcos and New Braunfels, this would have been maybe, gosh, maybe 14 years ago, 15 years ago. And there were Doolittle Raiders there and Flying Tigers and Tuskegee Airmen and Wasps and USS Arizona survivors. And so, you know, I was like a freaking kid at a, you know, freaking buffet. It was like, oh my gosh, just walking around with my autograph book, getting all these autographs and meeting all of my heroes. And I didn't know the Tuskegee guys were going to be there. So that was a super huge bonus. And incidentally, I actually got to take care of some of those guys in the ER through the years, a couple of colonels. But yeah, it was like really amazing. And that's when I walked up to the guy that was sitting on the bench. And I said, "Sir, are you a World War II veteran? Can I get your autograph?" He says, "Yes, I was a World War II veteran, but I was not on the sides that you are thinking." I was like, "Oh my god, that's amazing!"
You can still sign just in the back of the book. Autograph.
I was not on the sides that you are thinking. I was like, "Wow, oh, that is good. That doesn't happen very often." So, turns out he was in kind of like what our equivalent would be like physician assistant school, and the war was, you know, the Russians were approaching Berlin, and he said this sergeant just walked into their class one day and was like, "Everybody's infantry, grab a rifle."
Oh, crazy.
So he said that here we are, you know, medical people, like we're trying to save lives, and all of a sudden I have a rifle in my hand. He says, "Absolutely, they let us go." They pointed to the front lines. He says, "The first American I saw, I threw my rifle down and just surrendered." He says, "It was over. It was a hopeless." He says, "So I surrendered just as soon as I could." And he says, "And then I just came to America and I've just lived here ever since." And so that was really remarkable. But it was all from one of those air shows, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty good stuff.
I think I started going to air shows when I was in elementary school. Because as we mentioned in the past, I lived in Steeplechase, which was military housing during World War II. And then the 70s and 80s got converted to civilian housing. But it was on Rickenbacker Air Force Base. Which is now sadly like a FedEx and Amazon Depot. But at the time, yeah, we'd have air shows coming in. And Jeff used the phrase bigger than life. When you're like in third grade and you're walking through your first Hercules, that's a big ass bus, man. You're walking through that and you're like, wow, that thing's huge. Those were some big birds. And I remember, it's kind of embarrassing now, but it's like, when you're that age, you don't really realize depth and how things are smaller at a different range. And I remember it was like the first time I ever seeing paratroopers. And we're on the outside of the Air Force base, but we're over by where the loading docks were when they used to load up the military trucks. And they come over, and so we don't hear the PA system because we're outside of the gates. And so we just see this thing come over. And then all parachuting out. But like second grade me thinking, cool, parachute toys. I wonder if I can catch one. So you're like looking out for 5 minutes and you realize as I'm getting bigger and bigger, like, oh, stupid, those aren't toys. Those are real people. Because it's third grade, you know, you never seen something falling from that high. And so you're thinking, oh, cool, they're dropping little miniature army guys. I want to get me one. Then nope, they're getting bigger and bigger. And like, oh, okay, that's cool. I just had to look like such an idiot to all the other people standing around there. But... you know, and my brother was in Civil Air Patrol, and so sometimes we would go. It was cool, though, because they would rotate every other year. It was either Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels. Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels. Obviously, you can't have them there at the same weekend. That'd be gauche. But, yeah, we'd see that. And then I remember they would do the thing I'm sure every air show across the country did all day long. They announce, hey, whoever parked a blue Hyundai in this spot, you're going to be towed. You're going to be towed. And later on, you see the helicopter coming out, and they accidentally drop it, and it blows up. And so you see all that stuff. And awesome. Yep. I still remember one of the cool things about when he was in Civil Air Patrol. I'm like third grade. Bought my first album, like my first cassette. You know, your parents buy you stuff until a certain age, and then slowly they start allowing you to buy stuff. I bought my first tape cassette ever at the PX on the Air Force Base. I bought Iron Maiden's Only the Good Die Young, and we used to buy old helmet liners and like just 1980s green fatigue, so that when we were running around the neighborhoods playing guns like everybody did, we actually had the gear on. I used to go to the get my hair cut on base too, and be like fourth, fifth grade walking in, there's Playboy sitting on the table, and you're just like, da-da-da-da-da, just waiting to get your hair cut. But we had a lot of fun because even then the base, it was active Air Force base, but it was more of kind of like stop off to refuel and to, you know, on the way to bigger bases. But they had an old Sherman tank there, and we'd climb inside of it, and that's when you realize, oh, a lot got the old hand cranks and stuff. And so being a little kid climbing in the Sherman was really, really cool. And they just sat there, and we used to get all the time. And like I said,
did you ever make any? Did you have an 8mm? Did you get guys make any movies?
This was so long ago, and some of the listeners may remember this, especially if you're into vintage and retro toys. The short answer is no. We were still relatively poor at that point. My uncle, who owned a Z-Bart in Terre Haute, he had all the camera systems, and so when he came to town, we got to use his camcorders. But this was back, I remember the quote-unquote rich kid at our school. I'm sure his parents are like lower middle class, but for us, he was considered the rich kid. They had this little toy. It was marketed as a toy. It was a black and white video recorder, but it recorded onto cassette tapes. And since it recorded on cassette tapes, it wouldn't record audio. It was video only. But so he had one of those. I remember he brought it to school one time. I never got to see the finished product of it. But we thought that was the coolest thing ever. Wow, he's got a video camera. It's just, he's black and white, probably a little tiny square. But yeah, we never did get to record any of that stuff. I think I've told this story before. My brother got in RC cars for a short period of time, but he didn't want like an RC car you get on the Toys R Us and buy. No, he wanted one out of the model building magazines, the high-end ones. You know, at the time in like 1991, it seems like $150, $200 or whatever. And so he got one for Christmas. Him and my dad put this thing together, not realizing, hey, we're living on an Air Force base with some relatively modern day technology, but apparently there's some older technology. He'd be driving that thing down the street and something would just take the signal and that thing would just hang a hard left and slam right. Like we would always get radio interference. You couldn't drive the thing hardly because you'd get radio interference from the towers. And I can remember this day. So my bed would be on the left wall. My dresser would be on the right. And then on the wall directly in between the two was the window. And so on the water tower, they had the spinning light. And so it'd come through my window, hit my mirror, and smack me in the eye every time it rotated. And it used to keep me awake all night. But yeah, we had fun times. I mean, the old movie theater from World War II was still there. Obviously, it was shut down. I didn't because I was only in elementary school. But like the middle school and high school kids, they would go inside there and dick around. They had the old hospital. The on-premise hospital was there. It would have been all that stuff's gone now. But it would have been interesting to actually see that as an adult, this old World War II stuff that's all under mothballs. But for me, I was just third, fourth grade, skateboarding down there and riding bikes around there and just... It was just like a neighborhood to us. I mean, we, for some reason, they maintain the roads. Don't know if because it's government property, but you just have these 1, 2, 3 miles of just straightaways where all these warehouses used to be, but now they're gone. Just grid system of the perfect smooth blacktop. And so we would go out there on our bikes or our skateboards and just haul ass and just go to all these places. And we would get up in summertime and leave the house at 8. And just like you hear people say, we wouldn't come home until 9, 10 o'clock at night. We didn't have canteens or hydro flask with us. We just found water wherever we could, just out covering miles and miles of this pristine blacktop through the summers.
Wow, that's pretty good memory. You know, it reminds me, Spielberg famously would shoot video of not video, but 8mm, using his whatever was available to him and his buddies. That's how he started out.
I did in high school find an old Technicolor 16mm camera at a thrift store that I still have somewhere, but I thought was really, really cool. And I think I found a projector for it too, which I think is up at my mom's house. Never had to film for it, but yeah, I actually did come across an old Technicolor projector from like the 60s, which would have been cool. But yeah, 8mm definitely has a look to it.
Yeah, definitely. I enjoyed growing up on the Air Force base as a kid, DOD kid, Air Force brat. That was fun. That was a blast. And I'm one of my I still have PTSD from seeing the Fox and the Hound at the base theater. One of the early Disney movies where they kill off one of the characters you actually care about.
It's funny to say PTSD that. From that. Let's see. What year did E.T. come out? Now we're getting away from World War II here. So I was born in 1978. E.T. came out in 1982. So by no means was I very old. I can remember to this day, my grandmother took all the grandkids, and I was super young. I just remember waking up in this movie in the scene where E.T. is gray and dying, and then you have all the guys in like the full out. I just woke up, saw that, and freaked the hell out because I didn't see the whole beginning of the movie. I was 6, 5, just woke up and see this dying gray alien on the screen and these guys in the suits and the lights and all that. I just freaked the hell out. I can remember that, and I can remember seeing, I think, Return of the Jedi in the movie theaters. But yeah, those are some of those older things I can remember.
You know, I would say for me with air shows as a kid, it's the memories are so vivid. I think because it's all of your senses. It was like just a sensory overload being in an air show. And that's the first time I remember like smelling hydraulic fluid.
Yep.
You know, like being in these old aircraft, and there was something about that smell. And so for me, growing up in South Jersey, you know, very rural, big pine trees everywhere, and then just out in the middle of this, you know, basically out in nowhere, was this little regional airport in a little town called Lumberton, New Jersey. And it's still there. And the little airport diner is still there. When we go back and visit, I still eat breakfast there. Diner that overlooks the runway, you know, and they've got a couple large metal, big hangars, and they've got like a big metal building that's the museum. And it's one big open room, but there's a Tomcat, and, you know, there's an F-86 and a wooden, you know, 1-to-1 scale 109, and there's an A-6 intruder, like all this stuff. And then there's like cubicles with uniforms and different setups, you know, and then of course there's hundreds of model airplanes on display and dioramas, everything hanging from the ceiling, and just a neat little museum. Good place to stop in. But there's just something about that cool September weather in Jersey, right? It's kind of brisk in the morning and hot chocolate and my bomber jacket, you know, and then going out and smelling those airplanes. And I mean, that's where I would see, you know, 909, the B-17 909 came in, and the B-17 they used for the Memphis Belle. And you know, like Dennis was saying, I mean, that was just like, there'd just be pop-up, you know, canopies, the 10-foot canopies would just say, you know, Tuskegee Airmen. There'd be like 6 of them hanging out over there. And, I don't know. World War II vets were everywhere with their shorts and their socks and their fanny packs and their big glasses and, you know, it's like
ball comb overs.
And yep, big kind of oversized ball caps.
Trucker, you know, caps and, sitting high on the head.
Yeah.
Cameras.
But, yeah, the cameras around their neck. And I don't know. There was just something about just being able to, I don't know. I can feel the metal inside those airplanes. I can smell hydraulic fluid. I can hear the radial engines. I feel the weather. It, like everything about it just culminated. And it was like one of the coolest things in my childhood that, it never let go. I mean, here I wouldn't be sitting here, I think, if I never went to an air show as a kid. And I can only hope that kind of stuff, like I can only hope that kids are still that in tune with their surroundings. And I'm afraid that they're not. And maybe I'm a little overly, like, I'm a little more in tune than I think even most adults with what's around me. I don't know. I just kind of, I feel my surroundings. But
Jeff walks out there at the beginning of the air show and he goes, I love the smell of an air show in the morning. It smells like Jet A and deep fried food.
Well, hey, I mean, I'll be honest. My opening act was I spoke to all the parents and said, hey, if you're a parent that went to an air show as a kid, raise your hand. Keep your hand up if you brought your kid today to this air show. Right. And then, all right, give yourselves a round of applause, because that's how the legacy stays alive.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the World War II vets that I met as a kid when they were in their 60s and 70s, that are now, if they're still around, they're pushing 100, you know, they're pushing that 100 mark. And now my children have to keep it going when they're no longer here. There's no longer going to be a World War II vet to get the firsthand knowledge from, to ask to sign your book or autograph a glossy 8x10. It's not going to be there. And we have to be. So, and it starts, again, to me, I think it starts at an air show. And it's the core of American patriotism, because you can complain about the economy, you can talk about fuel prices, you can talk about the price of a vehicle and a house, and then all of a sudden, you're at an air show where people are dumping $30 for a funnel cake and a lemonade and watching a pair of A-10s blowing all kinds of jet fuel, you know, doing their burt-burt. And, you know, or a P-51 is paralleling it, or 47, and then a C-47 is taken off, and it's America.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's hot dogs and lemonade and funnel cake and cotton candy and airplane toys and bomber jackets and hat pins and World War II vets and guys like us that keep it alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me ask you two a question. I'll ask Dennis first.
Well said, well said.
Dennis, when it comes to 1980s era fighter jets, you had to choose your favorite. Which camp do you fall into?
Oh, definitely the F4 Phantom.
F4?
Yeah, definitely the F4.
Jeff?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a 25-year-old aircraft in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. But still, yeah, but see, I'm an Air Force brat, so I grew up with all that. And I knew all the jets. I knew what the Russians had. They were the enemy that we were going to be going to battle with at any time. And all the stories I was told were from guys who were getting ready to retire, and they were all F-4 pilots, or they were B-52 pilots. So for me, you know, it was always the F-4 Phantom just looked so badass. And the B-52, I mean, that was my favorite bomber, of course, except the B-17. But a B-52 was just awesome as well. But it had that big old, like, I just remember seeing those on the flight line. And it was like a tiger fin on the back. It was so tall. And it was like you could just imagine it cutting through water as a shark. You know, it just had that ominous look to it, right? And yeah, so with me, it was like not even a question. Like my favorite is all, even today, my favorite, still favorite fighter is the F-4 Phantom. Yeah.
Jeff.
Tiger teeth painted on the front.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I think the F-4, for what it was designed.
I'm not saying it was ever the best or anything like that. I'm just saying, I think the question was, what's my favorite?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, of all the jet aircraft, I think from that age, that sucker really, really lived up to its name and what it was designed to do. I mean, yeah, it was a huge fighter bomber strafer. It could be low and slow, or it could kind of handle itself in a dogfight. But yeah, as far as just favorite, so you said 1980, so I'm going to have to go with the F-15 Eagle, but I don't have a whole lot of favorite jets. But I got to say, my favorite is the F-117 Stealth Fighter. Seeing one of those as a kid at the Reading Air Show, or Mid-Atlantic Air Show, they call it now, in Pennsylvania, to see a stealth fighter and just to know, you know, how crucial they were at the outset of, you know, January 17th, 1991, and all those strikes into what became Desert Storm and Desert Shield. It's just a ridiculous-looking aircraft that you don't know if it's beautiful or hideous or a little bit of both. You don't know how it even like aerodynamically flies, but somehow it does. And for an aircraft that's 30 years old now or more, it's impressive to me. You know, I don't know. There's just something, it's unlike anything else that flew or has flown, you know? So
yeah, that's pretty cool.
I can't explain it. I doubt it wins any performance. I doubt it ranks very high. I don't know, because I wasn't into aviation at the time, and I really haven't looked into it. I don't know if it's because I saw them over at Rickenbacker all the time. They flew over a house. I've always been partial to the F-16.
F-16.
That's just my favorite little bird. Like I said, it probably doesn't rank up there, but we used to see them flying in and out of there all the time. I used to hear them.
They're pretty awesome aircraft.
And they're just a slick little – they just like – I don't know, it was kind of like a sports car, just slick little all over the place. I've just always been partial to the F-16. That was always my
favorite. You know, another one that always had my captured my imagination was the F-14. And I think it's because its wings would sweep back, which was, you know, when you're a an Air Force brat or and you're, you know, making models and you're sticking them on your ceiling.
Well, G.I. Joe had one too. Remember the G.I. Joe toy had one with the swift back wings. And it's so crazy that they gave the Cobras the Warthog.
Yeah, that didn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, that was the Warthog. Harrier jump jets are kind of cool for the time too, just because of their technology and how they would take off. Those were pretty cool. But
yeah.
And I also like the T-38s, the F-5s, the ones that they would always use to be the Russians in the movies.
Yeah.
Or the Iranians or whatever, or Libyans.
Watching Iron Eagle. Chappie! God. Iron
those
Eagle.
Those suckers were fast.
Iron Eagle was on heavy rotation on HBO in the day. Iron Eagle, what was it? Alien Mind. And then later on, like in the mid-90s, what was that Toy Soldier movie? The kid from before he did Lord of the Rings. They were at the all-boys school. They got taken over by terrorists, and so they're all getting like MP5s and rescuing the school. Yeah, it was called Toy Soldiers. It was a knockoff version. Yeah.
That's funny. What was that? What was that one executive decision? The one with the F-117? The nuclear... Was it Kurt Russell?
Executive I don't know.
Decision.
Not sure.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I think that's right. F-117.
Yeah, I think it was Sean Austin was in. I think it was Toy Soldiers, something like that. 1991 film. Yeah, Sean Austin was in it.
I remember being a kid at the freaking air show, and
that's why Luke Gossett Jr. was in there. It as well too.
The guy he had the. The little eyepiece comes over, you know, he flipped it over and he saw a bunch of us young kids were standing over there, you know, and he went like that. He looked over at us and the gun went like that, looked over at us. And we were all like, whoa,
spacey.
He went like that. Of course, you know, that was the coolest thing ever he could have done.
Yeah.
Made a little trigger finger thing. That was pretty awesome. I'll never forget that. Yeah, the air shows were fun too because they would always bring a bunch of ground stuff as well. That'd be like an Abram tank there, a Bradley, you know, Humvees, and they'd usually do like an airborne, right? They'd do a parachute drop in, an assault. Then of course all of us kids are getting our faces, you know, camouflage, and it's you know, you're freaking dying because it's like, you know, his people dropping left and right from heat stroke, and there's like
M16. If you're lucky, you had a toy M16, a floppy hat, a pair of dog tags, a big old Mountain Dew, and an elephant ear. That's all you needed.
Oh, man. It's good stuff. Love those air shows, man.
I heard Airwolf's going to be here.
Oh, man. That's good stuff.
We need more helicopter sitcoms. Yeah, good old days.
Those were the days. Who'd have thought 90s would be so freaking cool?
You know? Damn sight better than the 80s. I'm so happy that my quote-unquote high school year primes were in the mid to late 90s opposed to the mid to late 80s because I just not my bag, I guess.
Yeah, the 80s were awesome. I love the 80s.
I didn't like the 80s during the 80s. I don't like the 80s in 2024.
I loved it. I loved the music, movies. I had such a good time in the 80s. And it was fun riding my bicycle everywhere. Of course, I was on base, so I didn't have to worry about anybody picking me up and ending up on some documentary years later. But
Speaking of the 80s and 90s, they're making a new Beetlejuice. Did you guys see the trailer for that?
No.
Michael Keaton's playing Beetlejuice, of course. Winona Ryder's playing her character, but the girl who played in Wednesday's playing her daughter. She discovers Beetlejuice and hijinks ensue. But yeah, it's
nice.
Instead of them recasting it and remaking it, they're just making a part two-ish, I guess you would say, or a continuation of the storyline. So that'd be cool when it comes out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Jeff seeing Masters of the Air. Man, we're gonna have such a good time.
You gonna got watch my Bose
surround sound system up? We're gonna jack it.
There
it's
you
gonna
go.
Be wild, man. It's gonna be a lot of PTSD going on in here.
Your neighbors won't know to call the cops or the FAA.
Got the Bose lifestyles going. Subwoofer in the back.
Absolutely.
Memories.
Well, I'm reading a cool book. Is it too early?
No, what you reading?
Well, I mean, I'm in several books because I have to be. You know, my schooling has me. We're talking about the evolution of gunpowder, how it changed the face of war in Europe.
Boy, did it.
14th, 15th century, yeah. So that's keeping me busy. But sometimes you need, and I heard, I don't remember who it was, a couple weeks ago said, sometimes you need a junk food book.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, that's a really good analogy. You know, like sometimes you read so much heavy stuff that you just kind of need to lighten up a little bit.
Sure.
And so I you know, one of these paperbacks off the shelf, Black Thursday, about the raid on Schweinfurt in October of 43. And it's another Martin Caden. And I've read two or three of his books now. And Martin Caden was a big author in the right around 1960s, I guess, early 60s. And this guy is probably, I mean, from what I've seen, probably has more knowledge on the B-17 than anybody else I've ever seen printed. He has flown in B-17s. He flew in one of the three B-17s that was flown over to England for the making, I think, of the movie War Lover with Steve McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is before the 12 O'Clock High series came out. And there's a lot of footage you see from used in the War Lover that ended up in the 12 O'Clock High series later on in the 60s. But it's a quick read. Obviously, it's a little paperback, and this is actually a first edition I've got here from copyright 1960. And it's all just about that one day and leading up to it. But what I really thought was interesting is, and I know Dennis, you're the one that introduced me to on this documentary on YouTube called Target for Today. Just a really neat way to understand from the top down. And I think he introduces it with, at 8th Bomber Command, it was four words that set this into motion, which ended up being, you know, it was a very catastrophic raid. The losses were very heavy, for the bomb groups that had Schweinfurt that day. But it was four words, and it was, Schweinfurt it is then. And that's what put into motion from 8th Bomber Command down to the wing, down to the bomb groups, down to the squadrons, to the elements, to the pilots and navigators in their briefing that morning. So kind of seeing it from that perspective, and you really kind of get a feel for the how complicated it really was to organize one raid. And at this point in the war, in October of 43, it was mission 115 for the 8th Air Force already. October of 43.
No,
115 missions.
If I remember correctly, obviously the only way to make this work, because as you were just saying, the amount of energy it went into planning one particular raid, they were kind of almost looking at like you do a chess game, trying to figure out what your next move would be. So you would plan multiple raids out through different groups at the same time. That's how we were able to essentially roll these things out as quickly as we did. You didn't have, okay, we're going to plan this one, see how it turns out, and plan the next one. No, you look at the whole playing field of where you're going in your combat, and you have multiple planning groups planning multiple different raids at the same time throughout the calendar almost in advance.
Yeah, absolutely. And one, and you know, Schweinfurt and Regensburg and places like that were identified because of the ball bearing factories there. And I can't remember the exact statistic, but I want to say that there was like 47. I think it was 47 anti-friction bearings in one German 88. So the amount of bearings that it took for the German war machine, they heavily relied on these bearings. So
everything.
So to knock out the ball bearing factories, of course, was high priority. But you're right. I mean, it was, you know, it was places like Emden and Vegasack and Bremen and Wilhelmshaven and Lorient, Lille and Rouen, all these places, because of what they were producing there at the time. So, and Martin Caden goes into it in Black Thursday in this book, where it was basically like, what's the weather like? What's the weather like at this target? Okay, screw that. What's it going to be like here? How about here? Okay, that one it is. So weather, or what was predicted weather, let's not call it weather, let's call it a forecast.
Yeah.
A lot of times determined where these bombers were going. And yeah, but you're right. It was so complex to try to have several bomb groups going up, heading towards several targets. Some were the main force. Some were decoys to pull some of the aerodromes away. And you not only had to, you know, plan your route in, but it was a different route going out. And unfortunately, because of the location of places like Schweinfurt, there were times where the aircraft that were attacking them on the way in were the same guys that landed, refueled, rearmed, and went back up and were hitting them on the way out. So that's a statistic that I think gets overlooked when you, oh my gosh, there's so many aerodromes. Oh, there's a possibility that you could see 300 fighters today. Well, that's essentially a possibility of 600 fighter attacks.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the statistics so hard to say, oh yeah, we saw these so many airplanes on this raid today. You know, Dennis knows, they go into the debriefing hut and they get, I can't think of the term that they use when they come back from the mission. Interrogation. So in the interrogation room, they're trying to, you know, while everything's fresh, they're going through and these statistics, it sounds like this incredible amount of fighters, and there's no way the Germans put up that many airplanes. It was just the same guys, you know, that they saw on going in, that they saw coming out. So yeah, it makes it hard to determine when you're talking about enemy fighter encounter, how many fighters were actually shot down, things like that. You know, those statistics are so skewed. But it's been a really interesting book. It's been a fun, called a junk food, you know, book for me, since I've been stuck in the Middle Ages and coming up on the 100 years war in my studies. It's been fun to get back into a B-17.
Dennis, what you reading?
I'm reading a book called Those Who Fall by John Muirhead, who was a B-24 pilot, and he was shot down on the Polski raid and taken prisoner. It's riveting. Like, the guy is just a tremendous writer, and I have a writer's guild that I started here in Castroville, and I have used his book many times to illustrate how you can just so quickly and efficiently and beautifully bring somebody who's just nonchalantly walking by, grab them, bring them into the story, immediately immerse them into the situation and make them care about what they're reading. It's just beautifully written. Yeah.
That is definitely key for me when it comes to books. I need that hook, the thing that makes me want to keep on reading. Speaking of keep on reading, I'm still reading my Marauders book. It's been super hectic around here, but I'll make my way through that. And once I get a little deeper into it, I'm still reading through the whole logistics and the planning and the organization. They just got their name and all that stuff. Once I get a little more deep into their actions in Burma, for example, like right now they're discussing about how they had a total of 730 animals, primarily pack mules and horses. They ended up with more horses than they wanted because the last trip of pack mules coming over, the ship got sank. But the mule skinners didn't have enough time to adequately train the mules, so where they put the rigging on them and slowly add more and more weight and go on these longer hikes to get them acclimated to the load. once they start getting these mules in, they just start pushing them out and dealing with the repercussions of that and everything else. And so just how this organization came together so quickly and things got put in action, it's, there's a lot of buildup to getting to the actual campaigns themselves. So once I get a little deeper into the campaigns, we'll go over that stuff. But
that kind of hit me hard when you were talking about that last week. Or the week before, we were talking about Marine and Marauders. That kind of, I was sitting my chair driving home, and I was thinking about that conversation about the Marauders, and I was thinking about the jungle, Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up, and the Japanese, you know, they'd send like, you know, 70,000 guys, and like, you know, 500 would come out.
Yeah.
And it's like, here in America, we in the West, we put a lot of value on individual life. Like, everybody has value. Every person has some kind of talent that potentially could benefit the community. And it's everybody's goal to find out what everybody's good at, because then we all benefit from what they have. And here you have 70,000 guys that go into the jungle and they vanish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just never going to be found. Yeah. No one's ever going to. The jungle just swallowed these guys up. They had families. They had kids. Probably they just gone. It's just, yeah. I don't know why, but when you were talking about that 2 weeks ago, it just kind of hit me hard when I was reflecting on it. It was like, man, that's tough.
A little bit to the same note, but completely different. I remember, like, I didn't see the deer hunter until I was in my early 30s, and I was talking to my dad about it, and he was around when it was on the movie theater, and that was kind of like his takeaway is like, well, it was shown you the devaluation of life, human life, to, you know, the Viet Cong over there, and how they treated these guys and make a sport out of doing the Russian roulette stuff, and how they just, and talking about the severity of like how crazy that movie is. And that's kind of one of the things he was talking about. I was like, yeah, it's kind of one of the purposes of that movie is kind of show how Americans and how our military and our people, we have kind of a value on life, whereas other countries and other organizations, it's just a numbers game. Just keep pushing them out there. And, you know, we know how the Russians did with their guys. Here's, you get a rifle, you get a stripper clip. When he dies, you take his rifle and just keep on running. And some militaries just use that as their strategy, and some go a different route. But yeah. So,
well, even like the great effort that our country puts in even recovering those who were lost, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's just a really, it's such a comforting feeling whenever you can bring somebody back from Korea or from Vietnam, still from World War II, even at Tarawa, right? They're still finding guys at Tarawa. So, I mean, the effort that goes into that, Guadalcanal, the lady I took care of who was in my book, Clear, like, her husband, you know, was found still inside his P-38 in the jungle, in the bog, perfectly preserved. It's considered the best preserved P-38, and it's in Australia, getting refurbished. But yeah, just like the guys out there, and all of a sudden he sees a glint in the bog, and he makes his way through the muck, and here's this P-38, and then the next thing you know, the call's made, and here goes this high-tech team, and they take pumps out there, and they put all this effort into bringing him back. And that's just, I don't know, I'm just really proud of our country. That's one of the things I'm really proud of, what our country has done right, is not sparing expense, getting these guys and gals back.
Do you know how the ownership works on something like that? I know, for example, if you're a diver and you find some lost gold, like you find Spanish trinkets, Spain still owns that crap. You know, they'll take it to court to get it back. When it comes to recovered military artifacts like that, do you have to reach out to the origin country, say, this shit's 80 years old, I doubt you'll want it, but I have to file this paperwork? I mean, how does that sort of thing work when you find a well-preserved plane or tank or something somewhere because it's soaked in mud? I mean, is it just whoever's got the biggest winch claims it, or how does that work?
That's a good question. You know what? Actually, you just inspired me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to reach out, because I've actually contacted the guy that found it, from my book that I did. I'll maybe see if I can get him to come on the
yeah,
podcast.
Please.
He's in Australia, but it'll be a time difference. But since it's not live anymore.
Yeah, we can make it work.
Yeah, because he's got all kinds of stuff that he's found in the jungles, like equipment, aircraft, and this and that. And he's part of that team. That'd be really interesting to find out like what kind of legal stuff he had to do, even with Guadalcanal. Like, I'm not sure what country rules that now. Micronesia, what is it?
I can't remember off the top of my
head. But whatever, you know, whatever principality that he had to respond to or reply to and get the authorization. And then, yeah, but it's getting refurbished. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool. So we'll look forward to that on a future episode. I think for myself, Jeff Copsetta and Dennis Blocker, that's going to wrap up this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. We want to thank each and every one of you for your continued support. And next week, this will probably air on Easter weekend. So following this may be a best of, because the way we record these now, I think the three of us will be on a break for Easter Monday. So this show will probably air that week, but the following week will probably be a best of, because we will have burned through our backlog at that point. But either way, thank you guys for hanging out, and we will talk to you all on the next episode.
This has been a Digital 410 production.